This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 8th, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Mitt Romney lays out his positions on foreign policy as questions arise about his ties to labor conditions overseas. U.S. peace activists join thousands in Pakistan to condemn the American drone program. And as the U.S. reaches the 11th anniversary of the Afghan War, veterans speak out about the U.S. foreign policy, PTSD, and the impact on the economy. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Thousands of fishermen, along with anti-nuclear activists, used their boats and bodies to stage an offshore protest of the Kudankulam nuclear power plant on India's southern coastline. Shreya Niyazi reports.
The protesters came in boats and stayed in the sea 500 meters away from the nuclear plant. Citing safety concerns, they want the power station shut down, but the Nuclear Power Corporation of India Limited shows no signs of closing the plant, saying that the first unit has been fully loaded with the requisite enriched uranium fuel and it is safe. More than 5,000 security personnel were deployed to control the protest. Demonstrators led by the People's Movement Against Nuclear Energy say that villagers who oppose the plant have recently been arrested on false charges. They want the charges dropped and those detained freed. Anti-nuclear activists and local villagers have protested the seaside plant since last year's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster. They say they will take their protest to the Tamil Nadu Assembly in Chennai on October 29th. Shurenyazi, FSRN.
Farm workers and their advocates are hailing today's dedication of a national monument to labor leader and civil rights champion Cesar Chavez. In 1962, Chavez founded the National Farm Workers Association, which later became the United Farm Workers. The monument is near Keene, California, at Nuestra Señora Reina de la Paz, or Our Lady, Queen of Peace. Known simply as La Paz, the site was not only Chavez's home and UFW headquarters, it also served as an educational and organizational retreat for many. President Barack Obama's dedication of the monument today was criticized as an overly simplistic political ploy to garner the Latino vote. A Palestinian man injured yesterday in an Israeli airstrike is dead. Rami Al-Magari reports on the escalating violence along the border.
The 24-year-old man was one of two on a motorcycle targeted by Israeli authorities who confirmed the strike. They say the men were believed to be involved in an attack that killed an Israeli soldier at the Sinai border in June. Six Palestinian kids were among the bystanders hurt in Sunday's air strike. Israel also says their forces targeted the global jihadi group in Rafah on Saturday in an attempt to thwart a cross-border attack. In response, Hamas's military wing Izz al-Din al-Qassam and the Islamic Jihadi group jointly declared responsibility for a barrage of homemade rocket fire into nearby Israeli areas. No injuries were reported. The Israeli army retaliated with heavy fire on residential homes near the border fence in Khan Yunis city, south of Gaza. Gaza had seen a relative calm recently, as the ruling Hamas party has tried to broker a ceasefire in the region. Rami Al-Maghari, FSRN, Gaza.
The fourth session of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Palestine ended today in New York. The Global People's Court seeks to highlight the role that international forces play in the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. The first three sessions were held in Barcelona, London, and Cape Town. The New York session focused on the U.S. and the U.N.
The United States has aimed to make legal what is otherwise illegal.
Diana Bhutto, a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and former spokesperson for the PLO, addressed the so-called court.
What the United States has since done through the provision of the Oslo Accords was that it has flipped it on its head. Rather than the occupier being required to provide security to the occupied, rather than the occupier being required to protect the occupied, we are now in a very perverse situation in which the occupied the Palestinians, are required to give protection to their oppressor, Israel.
The tribunal's final findings will be presented at a closing session early next year. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In a major campaign speech today on foreign policy, Mitt Romney criticized President Obama's leadership on Afghanistan, Iraq, the Israel-Palestine conflict, and the transitioning Middle East. He said if elected, he'd pursue more free trade agreements around the world, increase the U.S. military budget, and take a, quote, stronger stance against Iran and Russia, though specifics of what he would do were few. Absent from the speech was any mention of human rights or workers' rights, and a recent investigation shows Romney profited from investments in companies that outsource jobs, some to places with a documented pattern of labor abuses. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Speaking at the Virginia Military Institute, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney echoed the with us or against us foreign policy mentality of the Bush administration.
America must have confidence in our cause, clarity in our purpose, and resolve in our might. No friend of America will question our commitment to support them. No enemy that attacks America will question our resolve to defeat them. And no one anywhere, friend or foe, will doubt America's capability to back up our words.
On the campaign trail, Romney has repeatedly vowed to back up his words when it comes to China, especially the country's currency manipulation, trade agreement violations, and human rights abuses. His website says about China, quote, a nation that represses its own people cannot be a trusted partner, and, quote, Mitt Romney will always stand up for those fighting for the freedoms we enjoy. Yet a recently published report from the Global Labor Rights Forum details Mitt Romney's past investments in companies that outsourced tens of thousands of jobs to Chinese factories. The author of the report, Charles Kernighan, described the factories as virtual prisons that use child labor in an interview with MSNBC's Ed Schultz.
These little kids were, you know, bent over the assembly line, and they're doing one operation every 13 seconds. And the workers, the students, it's hard. They say, if only the supervisor would fall down or have a stroke or something, we could finally sleep for a minute or two. I mean, these are kids, like six-year-old kids, and they'll be working 16 hours. 7 days a week. And, you know, it's wrong. It's cruel.
According to documents from the Securities and Exchange Commission, Romney invested around $23 million in the Global Tech sweatshop in Dongguan over 2.5 years. The company, incorporated in the British Virgin Islands, produces electrical appliances for Sunbeam, Mr. Coffee, Procter Silex, Revlon, Vidal Sassoon, and other well-known U.S. brands. They also make cell phone parts for Motorola, Nokia, and LG. In the same leaked video in which Romney made comments about the 47% of Americans unlikely to support him, he described a visit to Global Tech's Chinese factory.
As we were walking to this facility, seeing them work, the number of hours they work per day, the pittance they earn, living in dormitories with little bathrooms at the end of maybe 10 rooms, and the rooms, they had 12 girls per room, three bunk beds on top of each other. Have you seen that? And around this factory was a fence, a huge fence with barbed wire and guard towers. And we said, gosh, I can't believe that you keep these girls in. They said, no, this is to keep other people from coming in because people want so badly to come work in this factory.
Having traveled to China many times to investigate sweatshops, Kernighan called these comments absurd and said the barbed wire and guards are always used to keep workers from leaving the factory. In the MSNBC interview, he also criticized Romney for not using his leverage as an investor to pressure the company to improve conditions for workers after this visit to the factory.
You can tell there was no pushback against the miserable and illegal conditions in China. So they may have invested money in it, but they didn't lift a finger to say to the bosses, hey, wait a second, well, can't we improve the dormitories a little bit? Now, why we got these six-year-olds working here? What about, you know, having the food be a little better? Can the workers get a little better wage? Even in 2012, the workers are only getting a dollar an hour.
The report notes that the conditions at Global Tech are as bad today as when Romney visited the factory in the late 1990s, with widespread unsafe and unsanitary conditions and routine violations of workers' rights. Following the report's release in late September, the Obama campaign aired an ad accusing Romney of hypocrisy when it comes to China.
When Mitt Romney led Bain, they saw Global Tech as a good investment, even knowing that the firm promoted its practice of exploiting low-wage labor to its investors. Mitt Romney, tough on China? Since when?
The Global Tech investment is not the only past business decision of Mitt Romney's to come under scrutiny by human rights groups. Besides helping other firms outsource jobs to China, Brazil, and Mexico, he accepted millions of dollars in seed money from wealthy families tied to death squads in El Salvador. Questions surrounding outsourcing and international human rights could come up during the next presidential debate on October 16th, which is slated to focus on foreign policy. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Sunday marked the 11th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, which has become America's longest war, claimed more than 2,000 U.S. military lives, and left thousands more wounded. Veterans held a rally Sunday night at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Plaza in Manhattan to call for an end to the war and all U.S. wars of aggression and the healing of the warriors and the civilians affected. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus has more.
Long ago, once upon a time, two men did a crime. Tired of working for one thin dime.
About 100 veterans and their supporters gathered at sunset on the concrete plaza in the city's financial district. A Vietnam vet known as Watermelon Slim started off the rally with one of his politically charged songs.
Sacrifice for your business plan. Your profits are obscene.
Some veterans gathered were in military fatigues, while others were in civilian clothes, wearing caps marking them as members of Veterans for Peace, which sponsored the event. One of the veterans here is 24-year-old Micah Turner. He told the crowd he deserted from the Army a month ago after serving three tours in Afghanistan and one in Iraq over the past 5 years.
I'm doing it because this war is unjustified, because right now, our brothers and sisters are dying in the sand. Right now, people are living in terror. This war is not right. It's not justified. It's wrong. That's why I'm doing this, because it is our duty to dissent, not just my duty. It is our duty to dissent, to tell the government to either come forward with a realistic reason or to let our people come home.
Turner said he was planning to turn himself in before midnight Sunday so he wouldn't be charged with desertion. He expected to serve at least 6 months in prison and hoped it wouldn't be longer than the 13 months he has left on his current tour of duty. Another participant, Iraq War veteran Jenny Pakanowski, recited a poem written to honor the growing number of veterans, both active duty and returned, who commit suicide, an act she says she couldn't follow through on.
I was missed by IEDs, bullets, mortars, RPGs. Is it luck? Was it God? Was it the devil? Why did I survive only to come home to a war with an invisible enemy in my own skin? I live in a dream called my life, where good things don't seem real or sustainable. I live in the nightmares of the past, called Iraq and PTSD, that never run out of fuel.
Pakanowski, a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, now works in upstate New York on a veterans sanctuary program offering holistic healing through art. PTSD is also a challenge for Javier Ocasio, who served 15 years in the Army and was in Iraq in 2006 and 2007. As a helicopter mechanic, he says he did not see a lot of direct combat, but still suffered from extreme PTSD and is 80% disabled. He said when he returned, he couldn't relate to his two-year-old daughter. When she died of a sudden illness at age 4, he said he understood better what families in war zones feel when their children are killed.
So when I look around at everybody, when I look at all the organizations trying to change the world, when I look at what needs to happen, the responsibility of the death of every parent or every child that has been caused by the U.S. and our wars falls entirely on our shoulders. On the policemen standing over there, and on us standing right here. I feel that responsibility entirely, completely, and I accept it holistically.
Ocasio said he left the Army after his daughter's death, is getting divorced, and now works full-time with Occupy DC. His goal is to unite the disparate groups of people working to end the war. Others at the event pointed out the impact of the wars on the economy. Speaking as the city's Columbus Day fireworks exploded nearby, Vietnam veteran Christopher Jameson said the U.S. government needs to reprioritize its spending.
I see a lot of my friends and my neighbors that are unemployed and can't find jobs. The country is spending tens, hundreds of billions of dollars on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the need that we have for that money to be spent here in this country for our schools and for our highways and for our infrastructure and put people to work. That's why I'm here tonight.
Police arrested those who refused to leave after they said the park was officially closed at 10 p.m. Those detained said they were standing up for veterans' right and duty to assemble and organize. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New York.
In Pakistan, tens of thousands joined an anti-drone march led by politician Imran Khan. Among the participants were members of the U.S.-based group Code Pink, who traveled to the country to meet with drone victims' families and the U.S. ambassador. While the marchers were stopped short of their final destination in South Waziristan, many say they succeeded in drawing worldwide attention to the controversial U.S. drone program and its impact on civilians. FSRN's Shauna Ray reads for our reporter in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews.
The two-day-long march started in the capital, Islamabad. Participants played traditional drum and reed instruments to launch the procession. The peace march was organized by Imran Khan and his Movement for Justice party. The former cricket player vowed to carry out the march condemning U.S. drone strikes, despite the threat of terrorist attacks and the Pakistani government's announcement that they couldn't be responsible for the security of the participants.
All they said was they won't provide security, but we were always going to get security from the people of Waziristan, who welcomed us. The tribes welcomed us. There have been various talks with them over the past week, and all of the tribes, there are four tribes, the Masood, the Barki, the Wazir, and the Bittani, all of them have welcomed us. My worry was, as I said, our guests who've come all that way here, these human rights activists, they're real heroes.
The final destination of the 300-mile-long peace march was supposed to be Kotkai, a town in South Waziristan. But demonstrators didn't know whether they'd get that far after authorities said they wouldn't be allowed to enter the area. The threat of attacks may have convinced many to stay home. 27-year-old engineer Nadim Ali says he couldn't persuade his parents to give him permission to participate, but he came anyway.
We want to show the world that drones kill innocent people with the support of our government. If they would come to know about the reality, then they would strongly protest against the drones. It is a march for peace in the tribal regions of Pakistan, and tribal people are peace-loving people. We want to convey to the world through the peace march that hundreds of thousands of tribal people only demand peace in the area.
Thousands of people waved the V sign for peace and welcomed the marchers as they passed through towns. The convoy included hundreds of vehicles, including those used by the delegation of U.S. and U.K. activists who came to denounce U.S. policy and drone strikes in the region. 22-year-old Feza Zishan has come from Lahore, the cultural capital of Pakistan, to participate in the peace march. She's one of the few women demonstrating and says everyone has been very supportive.
You won't believe it that people are so welcoming here. I mean, everybody else was waving us and we were so amazed to see people here. They were so much welcoming and they were so happy to see us here, as if they were waiting for us. And we could not imagine that it would be such a success. I had no idea that the people are so nice and they are not at all extremist like the impression that the international media has given.
Demonstrators were determined to go as far as they could, even removing freight containers blocking the road. But when they reached Dabara, the army had cordoned off the road with barbed wire. Despite not reaching their final destination in South Waziristan, many said the peace march was a success. As night fell, Imran Khan spoke to thousands who remained, saying they sent a loud and clear message to the international community.
Drones are a violation of human rights. It is against international law. Drones are a violation of the basic human rights of Pakistanis. I want to convey a message to the United States that the more drone attacks, the greater the hatred of Americans, and the more people will resist against the U.S. The tribal people are not scared of drones.
Reading for Gabe Matthews, I'm Sean Ray at FSRN.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues, our investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people, and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. In Venezuela, voters elected President Hugo Chavez to a fourth term in office Sunday. Voter turnout was high in the closest race of Chavez's near 14 years as president. According to the National Electoral Council, Chavez received 54% of the vote, his opponent, Enrique Capriles, 45%. Chavez greeted crowds at the Miraflores Palace in Caracas Sunday, saying he was making an appeal to his detractors.
Y les hago el llamado a todos. A los que andan promoviendo el odio, a los que andan promoviendo el veneno.
To those promoting hatred, Chavez said, those trying to deny all the good things that are happening here in Venezuela, I invite you to dialogue, to debate, and to work together for Bolivarian Venezuela. For more, we go to Caracas to speak with National Lawyers Guild President-elect Azadeh Shahshahani. She's part of a group of international monitors in the country. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Electoral Commission saying more than 80% turnout at the polls. What did voters you talked to say about the candidates and what motivated them to come to the polls?
Well, you know, we were mostly concerned about the feeling of people about the integrity of the electoral process. And obviously, you know, people had different feelings about the different candidates. And, you know, this was a particularly contentious election and watched all around the world. But, you know, what was important to us is how much confidence people had, you know, every voter had in the integrity of the system. You know, people had a lot of trust in the integrity of the system, which again was exhibited by the high turnout.
There's also a new electronic voting system put in place for this election. Tell us first how the program works.
Right, so the way it works is that, you know, once your fingerprints are taken, the machine is activated and there is an electronic ballot with you know, different political parties linked to different candidates, and you choose whoever you want to vote for. And I should say that, you know, you're covered by a cardboard box on all sides, so, you know, other people in the polling station cannot see who you're voting for. And then after you, you know, choose your candidate, then the machine prints a receipt. Or, you know, a paper ballot, and you look at it, you make sure that, you know, the person that you chose on the electronic machine was the same person who shows up on the paper ballot, and you go and place that in a box, and then you go through the checkout, and if there is an irregularity, you file an incident report.
And from your assessment, from what you observed yesterday, how did that system work?
It worked great. I mean, it was very organized, you know, very transparent, and the system was uniform. So, you know, I myself went to six different polling stations yesterday, went to different rooms in each polling station, and, you know, the system was running, pretty much smoothly. And in some places there were long lines of voters, but, overall, it was, obvious how the system was supposed to work and, obvious that there had been a lot of practice and training ahead of time. And so, except for a few glitches here and there, machines breaking down the day of the elections or, power outages, I think overall the sense was that the system was working as they had meant it to.
You also met with representatives from opposition candidate Henrique Capriles' camp. What was their take and assessment of the election process?
Right. So we met with somebody from the Capriles campaign a couple of days before the elections, and they said that they were very confident in the integrity of the electoral system and that whatever the results were, it would belong to the Venezuelan people. And we also, a couple of days before the elections, where we went to a polling station, and also on the day of the elections, there were monitors from the two major campaigns, the Chavez campaign and the Capriles campaign, at each voting station. And, we made sure to talk to them to find out if they had noticed any irregularities, if there were any complaints, any distrust in the integrity of the system. And everybody that I spoke to, and I know that others in our delegations spoke to, expressed confidence and trust in the integrity of the system. So I think that was very positive.
Well, in response to the outcome of this weekend's election in Venezuela, the U.S. State Department issued a statement congratulating the Venezuelan people for the high turnout and what it called a general peaceful voting. And the department also said that they believe the views of the more than 6 million people who voted for the opposition should be taken into account going forward. Now, from what you saw over the weekend and observed, are there any indications of U.S. involvement on the ground in this process?
No. I mean, at least not overtly. I'm sure the U.S. government has keen interest in the outcome of the elections. But, obviously, at the end of the day, this is very much up to the Venezuelan people. And, people in Venezuela, as well as in other Latin American countries, are very much aware of the long history of, really destructive U.S. involvement in Latin American countries. And they very much care about the sovereignty of their country. And even though I think, people would like to work closer with the U.S., they wouldn't want to do that at the cost of their sovereignty and, especially their natural resources.
Azadeh Shashahani is president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild. She joined us from Caracas, where President Hugo Chavez has won a fourth term as president. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.